Listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded June 24th, 2026. Well, as anticipated, British PM Keir Starmer resigned Monday, becoming the latest in a long string of prime ministers to leave office without facing, post facto, their electorate. Fitting, too, following Starmer's monkey-wrenching of Labour Party policy, making it indistinguishable from the Tories, and backing Israel's genocide to the hilt. It's a lesson Canada's freshly majority-mandated Liberal Party leader Mark Carney would do well to heed. Carney, like Starmer, has U-turned on his election platform, rushed through draconian safety and security bills, supports the 21st century Holocaust in Palestine, and has made Liberal policymaking indistinguishable from his right-wing parliamentary colleagues across the aisle. Eve Engler is an activist journalist and the author of countless articles and essays detailing Canada's foreign policy history. He's written a dozen books on the subject, including Stand on Guard for Whom? A People's History of the Canadian Military, House of Mirrors, Justin Trudeau's Foreign Policy, Left Right, Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada, and his latest is Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. Eve's website, eveengler.com, is the necessary first stop for Canadians and foreigners alike wishing to understand better the cognitive dissonance that lay between the proclaimed and demonstrable Canada. Eve Engler in the first half. And thanks to its unlamented outgoing Prime Minister, Britons are now stripped of basic protections from tyranny in the form of laws in place for nearly 1,000 years. While departing Starmer isn't the sole architect of what one British journalist calls, quote, a legal architecture of repression, he and Labour built upon and reinforced that repression, now being sprung on both thousands of everyday citizens and the resistance group Palestine Action. Andy Worthington's an English journalist, activist, author, photo historian, filmmaker, musician, songwriter, and principal of the Forefathers Band. He is, too, a co-founder of the ongoing Close Guantanamo campaign. His book titles include The Guantanamo Files, the story of the 774 detainees in America's illegal prison, Stonehenge, Celebration and Subversion, and The Battle of the Beanfield. Andy's articles appear at andyworthington.co.uk and at his eponymous Substack site, where I found his recent post, How Were the Filton Four Sentenced for Terrorism When They Weren't Convicted of Terrorism? Andy Worthington and arousing the most punitive instincts of authoritarian ministers and compliant members of the judiciary in the second half. But first, Eve Engler and Canada on the Carney fast track to moral and material ruin. Welcome back to the show, Eve.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's always my pleasure, of course. Now, Eve, before getting to Mark Carney's deliberate undoing of the country, the shooting in your city has found its way into the anti-Semitism arena. What happened in Montreal Monday?
Well, an Albertan from someone from Lethbridge came to the city, drove here, it appears, staying at a Hilton hotel right across from the Pornhub offices, and appears to have shot at those offices, and then left his hotel room and engaged in some sort of shootout with the police. Police officer accidentally killed a bystander, and he left a big, long, 100-and-some-odd page manifesto, which seems to be focused mostly on hatred towards women. But all of the sort of pro-genocide influencer kind of network immediately said this was taking place in a Jewish neighborhood, that it was this sort of terrorist attack against Jews. There was some claims that the individual who was killed, who was the bystander who was killed, who was ultimately Jewish, people said that he was a rabbi at some point. They said that kosher food store was targeted. There was some erroneous claims about this PA store, grocery store, that's absolutely not kosher. It's owned by Greek Montrealers. And the neighborhood does, in the vicinity, a few blocks away, some significant Jewish institutions, but the neighborhood is not predominantly Jewish whatsoever anymore. There are actually predominantly Jewish neighborhoods in Montreal, Hampstead and Côte-Saint-Luc. Those are not where this took place. And it got even to the point where it got on Al Jazeera. I was listening to 5 o'clock Al Jazeera global English news, and they even mentioned it in Al Jazeera as the shooting had happened in a Jewish neighborhood. And really what this is just everything is cranked up to maximum on these claims of anti-Semitism. And you can, you know, get into the details of each one of these claims. I've myself looked at lots of them, and they're just completely, you know, sort of fabricated often. But the big picture is that all this cranking up to maximum of anti-Semitism is just an effort to deflect, to protect Israel from criticism of its genocide, of its, you know, 80 years of apartheid, of its ethnic cleansing, etc. And incredibly, you know, 3 years into this, these horrors in Gaza, into the lawlessness and killing in Lebanon ongoing, and the attacks against Iran, and the, you know, bombings all across the region, they're still able to get major media outlets around the world to amplify, to echo what are, you know, just totally outlandish claims. And these Zionist influencers on X that got this whole thing going, you know, they know, some of them, they, you know, they're, some of them from Montreal, they know this is not a, this is not like a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. It's a, it's actually a very multiracial, multi-ethnic. If you go walking in the neighborhood around there, you, you know, it's heavily Filipino background, Black, South Asian, actually more Arabs. The police officer who was killed is Arab background. So it's just it's pretty fascinating to see, and pretty wild that it keeps going. But it's part of the unique ideological stick that Israel and its backers wield in Canada, and particularly in the Western world.
Well, the neighborhood, when I was reading about the neighborhood in Montreal, I don't know Montreal very well, but it sounded a lot like Toronto Spadina area and Kensington Market area, with the really wide mix of different ethnicities and cultures, and what really actually makes the city an interesting place to begin with. Ben Mulrooney, the former prime minister's son, was foremost amongst those hyping this false assertion that this was a primarily Jewish area, and that this was therefore an attack against the Jews. But then Ben is well known for his promotion of all that. So has this been resolved now? Has this been properly debunked, or do we have to talk more about it, that this is not a Jewish area?
The dominant media has just ignored it, including most of the pretty hardline Zionists, because it's just kind of a bit of egg on the face of the sort of Zionist influencer network for having hyped this up. The really hardcore people are trying to continue with the claims. In the manifesto, there's apparently some footnote in the manifesto. I actually read the footnote that does mention Jewish people, Zionism. It's actually the footnote I read. It was not. In fact, it was kind of arguing against anti-Semitism. But they're trying to, you know, parse out this or that. I haven't read the full manifesto. I read multiple stories from it. My understanding is that the overwhelming thrust of this guy's politics are anger towards women.
Does this bring up memories of Mark Lapine?
Yeah, I mean, and there was some speculation early on that this was, because it's not that far from the Université de Montréal, where Lapine, of course, massacred a whole bunch of women in 89. It's not that close. I don't think there was any connection. I think it's I don't know that it's been, you know, 100% confirmed, but it's widely reported in the French media, at least, that it's, you know, he was shooting at this Pornhub office, and there's images or photos of windows having been busted out. So it appears that's what he started with. He started to shoot from his hotel room into this Pornhub office. And then the people called the police, seeing that there was a rifle coming out of this hotel. And then I guess he went down to the floor, you know, whatever it is in English, the first floor of the hotel, and you know, engaged in a shootout with the police.
Okay, well, so the parliament broke for the summer. But before going, Carney managed to stick his foot in the shit again, this time getting caught on a live mic talking with, I forgot who it was now, some other leader, and basically, you know, dissing his own MPs by saying, oh, well, don't worry, my MPs are just filling suits and seats and they just vote and they're not worth it. I'm paraphrasing. Did you catch the faux pas by the Prime Minister?
Yeah, I saw a few posts about it.
Is Donald Trump starting to rub off on him? Is he getting a little orange around the gills here?
Yeah, I would imagine it's actually more fundamental to Mark Carney's, probably more of decades, Goldman Sachs and as chair of Brookfield Asset Management and head of the Bank of Canada and the Bank of England. I would assume that that's the arrogance. I personally witnessed that when I bumped into him on the street next to an event with where Emmanuel Macron and Justin Trudeau were meeting, and I tried to ask him a question. You can see it on the video I posted. There's pretty flagrant kind of arrogant sort of attitude. So I would presume it's not to sort of be nice to Donald Trump, but that this is something that Mark Carney has had. I know there's been lots of reports about how he's quite nasty to MPs in private. Toronto Star has reported on that. There's a fair bit of complaints from the MPs. But it's the logic of what he's trying to do, I think, is he's trying to... He ran on a platform that, they talk about climate change. They don't talk about huge amounts of military spending. And in fact, what he does is follows a wealth-concentrating pro corporate ecocidal policies, radical militarism, and it's policies that he didn't win the election on. It wasn't like, you go look at the platform. I know that I've seen that with the climate stuff. They would talk about climate change repeatedly in the platform, and yet he completely flips on that. Same thing with. There's nothing in the platform on this military spending increase. So this is Carney just, he's kind of anti-democratic, kind of, we're going to push forward our agenda. And his agenda is very clearly one of pro-rich, pro-corporation, pro-empire. And I would say that that's this kind of disdain or indifference to the views of even elected liberal MPs is kind of flows from that.
He seems like such a nice old poop, hardly contemptuous of the hoi polloi at all. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Eve Angler. Eve's an activist journalist and the author of countless articles and essays detailing Canada's foreign policy history. He's written a dozen books on the subject, including Stand on Guard for Whom? A People's History of the Canadian Military, House of Mirrors, Justin Trudeau's Foreign Policy, Left Right Marching to the Beat of Imperial Canada. His latest is Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy. Well, we'll get to the environment in a second, Eve, but I meant with Carney, with the orange rubbing off from Trump, the dumbassery, not the arrogance. I mean, by saying something like that on an open mic, but I mean, maybe, he was sending a message with that. I don't know. But he also was said something stupid in a interview with CNN with Caitlin Collins. He had the tone deafness to reiterate, and this was a setup coming from a mile away. Anybody could have noticed this when she asked him, Caitlin did. Was the Iran war worth it? I'm being unfair and not providing the entire context. But Carney, after some rambling, says that, yes, the Iran war was worth it. He seemed to be saying that Iran promising not to develop a nuclear weapon was worth the thousands of Iranians killed. And who knows how many more will be. It's not like it's over, really. What's your response?
I actually think that's, it's consistent with what he's said and done on Iran. His immediate statement was to support the act of aggression. They backed away from it when there was quite a significant pushback. They kind of backed away a little bit, but they never condemned any of the aggression or the killings. Like, there's been huge push for the Canadian government to criticize the killing of 168 at a girls' school on the first day. They've never done that. But simultaneously, they put out at least, I'd say, at least two dozen, maybe even more, statements saying, you know, criticizing Iran for shooting missiles at U.S. bases in UAE or Bahrain or whatever, right? They put out all these statements. Whenever they had a chance to claim that Iran was the aggressor, they would put out a statement. They haven't done anything in terms of, you know, lessening Canadian ties to the U.S. military, including in the region. That almost certainly assisted, obviously, through NORAD, assisting the flyovers, the U.S. flying over Canadian airspace. And it fits with his broader imperial position on, you know, everything from Venezuela to Haiti to Palestine. And, you know, this is a guy who you know, I'm sure that Mark Carney views what Trump did as geopolitical error. Because I think that everyone in the G7 and almost everyone who's at all thinking sees the error from the U.S. Empire's perspective in this act of aggression. But I think that he basically, you know, he's completely fine with imperial aggression. He's completely fine with this unjust global order and asserting that or strengthening that. He has some complaints or some disagreements when that, you know, when Trump turns on, you know, a NATO ally like Greenland, or potentially turns on Canada. And he has some disagreements when, you know, there's Canadian corporations and Canadian capital get undercut by some of Trump's trade and, you know, measures and stuff like that. But there's I've seen no indication that there's any sense of you know, moral disagreement or concern with, you know, the impoverished being further subjugated around the world. So I think you know, what he said, I mean, I think that, you know, in the narrow sense, Carney is trying to placate Trump. That's, you know, he's trying to say things that he thinks Trump will like. But it's not out of his it's not out of his character. It's not out of his worldview.
I wonder about his, you know, his tone deafness and his. I mean, is he so out of the loop to fall into the trap and use the exact phrase put to Madeleine Albright so many years ago about Bill Clinton's sanctions campaign against Iraq that was credited at that point of being responsible for the deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children. And when asked if it was worth it, she fell into the trap, Albright did, infamously. And I'm just guessing that either Carney doesn't read history or he is really that blatantly uncaring about it to say, yeah, that it's worth it to kill gymnasiums full of volleyballers and innocent children to further a goal that was accomplished before the first bomb fell anyway, with Iran's promising not to develop nuclear weapons, you know, decades.
Yeah, well, that's a part of the complete lie. Mark Carney knows completely that this act of aggression was not to do with Iran and nuclear weapons. I mean, there was a deal on the table as Oman. There's obviously the JCPOA that the first Trump administration ripped up. So there's, you know, there's statements from the Supreme Leader going back many, many, many years, making all that clear. So, in fact, all that this war has done is probably, increase the likelihood that Iran would go that direction.
And he said that Iran, just to compound his idiocy, he said Iran must learn to be civilized.
Yeah, well, but that to me is, and I would say the same thing with Albright, and so you say they get caught in a trap, and I think there's a truth to that, but the problem for them is that they really do believe these things, and they think that, you know, many people, most people believe these things, or, you know, view the world from that lens. Now, I think it was a mistake on Carney's part, and part of the way you see that is that, to his credit, Avi Lewis, the leader of the NDP, went pretty hard on that, and other NDP MPs picked that up the worth it comment and push back on that. And so they clearly see political hay to be had in criticizing Carney for that, statement. Correctly so, because most Canadians don't support the war. And I think most Canadians are, have soured pretty clearly on Israel and have clearly soured on Donald Trump. I think in that sense, Carney did make a political error in employing those words, but it does fit with his broader. And they boasted about, like Carney boasted about targeting Iran, right? Like he said, one of his first things he did when getting in office was adopting some more sanctions on Iran. So this business of like civilized, we are the, this is the human rights abusing country, and we are going to bring, human rights and women's rights and democracy and whatever, all the good stuff that Carney, and we're going to do it by suffocating your economy and trying to subjugate the nation. This is stuff that Carney pursues, and I think he does actually believe this kind of stuff, and so the civilization kind of comments fits within that lens as well.
Well, and talking about suffocating economies, now, as I mentioned, the parliament rose June 19th. The Carney government, before breaking for the summer, they brought in a whole raft of bills. They've deployed a couple of omnibus bills this year, and they cut a debate on others. One of them was Bill C-30. This was the pesticide ban that they lifted. It seems that one of the patterns here is that this government is taking out of the hands of those suits that are just filling seats and raising their hands when requested to and clapping as demanded, is taking any decision-making out of the parliament and handing it into the minister's hands. And this Bill C-30 lifts the pesticide ban that's been in place for a few decades now and puts it onto the plate of Marjorie Michel, the Minister of Health. Have you followed this, Eve?
I mean, I read a CBC story about it, and, basically even pesticides that have already been banned by Health Canada, now the cabinet can just overturn that. It's a pretty egregious attack against public health, against science, and obviously in service of corporate profits, and it's an empowerment of the minister and cabinet, but it's and obviously not something that Carney ran on in the election, right? It wasn't like we're going to give cabinet power to overturn Health Canada decisions on dangerous chemicals
or applying strychnine to killing all the squirrels in Saskatchewan. Vote for me and we'll kill the squirrels. I didn't hear that on his platform somehow. Well, the David Suzuki Foundation and a whole raft of other environmental groups in Canada have raised hell about this. They've complained. Senator Rosa Galvez wrote something good. She says that, quote, substituting political judgment for scientific expertise, the cabinet is overruling science. The David Suzuki Foundation article, they say it's the largest overhaul of pesticide rules in a generation. And that was reported by the CBC, a quote from the David Suzuki Foundation. The David Suzuki Foundation, though, they backed off of the Climate Solutions Prize Festival recently because that was hosted by people that you're well familiar with, the Jewish National Fund.
Yeah, well, we were able to get David Suzuki himself to withdraw. He was the keynote speaker for this event, this conference that is set up by the Jewish National Fund of Montreal in alignment with the Israeli government. Naftali Bennett, the former prime minister in Israel, gave a kind of positive statement when the Climate Solutions Prize was launched in Israel, and other ties to the JNF in Israel, the parent organization. So he withdrew. That was good. That was a positive. That we had a protest there a couple weeks ago in front of the Climate Solutions. But amidst this, I learned that Stephen Bromfield, Kampfman is on the board, the vice chair of the David Suzuki Foundation, the vice chair for Quebec. Stephen Bronfman, as I published in a piece, is from the most prominent anti-Palestinian family in Canadian history. And he himself is heavily invested in Israel. His Claridge, his company, in fact, the Quebec pension plan withdrew. It's not exactly clear when, but sometime late last year, it appears, from its investments with Claridge in Israel because of protests, criticism of you know, complicity in genocide. So Stephen Bronfman and, you know, his father, Charles Bronfman, set up the Birthright, set up a whole slew of Zionist anti-Palestinian initiatives. And then the great-grandfather ran guns to the Haganah in 1947 and 1948, involved in the Nakba, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine during that period. And my
great grandfather, I'll just put this in, ran rum for the Bronfmans back into the United States from the Canadian prairies way back when.
Okay, yeah, well, that's how they became wealthy, is through during Prohibition, the bootlegging, and apparently also running brothels on the prairies in Manitoba and so Stephen Bronfman has given a lot of money, I think it's about $8 million, to the Suzuki Foundation over the years. I think this is how, and also another character who was the former, who was one of the people who set up the Climate Solutions Prize. He's a former JNF honoree and is actually in charge of the combined Jewish Federation appeal fundraising this year, right now in 2026 here in Montreal. He's a staunch Zionist. I'm blanking on his name right now. That's who I think got David Suzuki into this Climate Solutions Prize keynote speaking situation. To his credit, to Suzuki's credit, he did withdraw. He decided that he didn't want to have anything to do with something that was set up by the JNF. The next step, though, or the next question is why does the Suzuki Foundation have Stephen Bronfman on his board? Stephen Bronfman is head of fundraising for the Liberal Party. He boasted about bringing Justin Trudeau to Israel, and in fact suggested that Justin Trudeau's before the 2015 election was more pro-Israel than Stephen Harper. So Stephen Bronfman is somebody who is deeply attached to Zionism. He's somebody who is, got all kinds of scandals of, avoiding taxation by Caribbean Trust and stuff like that. But I guess, the nature of these foundations, including one that associated with somebody who you think has a little bit better politics, is that they're focused on getting money. And so Stephen Bronfman is somebody who is capable of giving money, and is also someone who is capable of, well connected with other people who can give money. So that's probably the logic. But I think that there are people within the Suzuki Foundation, I've heard, who are very uncomfortable about this connection to this leading anti-Palestinian family.
Well, what I'm uncomfortable about is that this government also jammed through Bill C-9, Bill C-36, and Bill C-22, Bill C-9, the Combating Hate Act, which may, and we don't have time, sadly, to talk about all this today, Eve, but that may have a big effect on the kind of work that you and I do, and all journalists and activists in this country. Coming up, there are a raft of more than 60 civil liberties and human rights and faith-based and community organizations denouncing Bill C-9, the Combating Hate Act, as it's called by the government. And we've seen what happened in England and in Australia when they brought in similar legislation. In fact, after we get off the phone, Eve, I'm going to be talking to Andy Worthington in London, and we're going to talk about the price they're paying, especially through Palestine Action and its activists, for this very kind of legislation being imitated by this government, slammed through, and then they duck out the back door, and now he's off playing polo with King Charles or something somewhere, I imagine. Eve, it's always a joy to talk with you. EveAngler.com. Find Eve's work there. The Paradise Files talks about the Bronfman tax dodgery quite well. Thanks a lot, Eve, for coming on again, eh?
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I'm going to take that brief break now, and I'll be back with Andy.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire, fire.
Some folks think that just because they lead a major nation, it's their God-given right to come.